Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and His kingdom. The dangers associated with the Russian invasion of Ukraine continue to escalate. Reports of the torture and murder of large numbers of civilians in Bucha and elsewhere are increasing demands for Western intervention. They may also be increasing the risks that Vladimir Putin will decide to use tactical nuclear weapons to bring the conflict to a prompt end on his terms. Our first guest is a man who has studied these issues closely. He is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. His name is Peter Husey. He's an expert on nuclear deterrence matters, arms control, and related topics. He has, since 1983, been a convener of an unbelievable large number of events, breakfasts, lunches, dinners, and nuclear weapons symposia. Some 22, I believe, over the years. And he has also really, I think, helped shape an awful lot of people's thinking about these topics. And it's very good to have him with us. Peter Husey, welcome back to Securing America. Let me start by asking you a bit about the context here, Peter. Putin is a man who has taken, I would argue, very seriously the idea of nuclear war fighting. We've told ourselves for a long time that, it cannot be fought, it cannot be won, these nuclear conflicts. He doesn't seem to believe that. You participated in an important webinar that our Committee on the Present Danger China convened, I guess, about 2 weeks ago now, in which we explored that. Talk a little bit about some of the most important takeaways from that, which, again, people can see for themselves at presentdangerchina.org.
Well, the issue is, it used to be thought that if there was a conventional conflict with Russia, it might escalate to the nuclear level, but that both sides would have an interest in not going there, because then you would go to what we considered Armageddon, which is everybody dies, it's mutual suicide. We called it mutual assured destruction, but technically, starting in the Kennedy administration, we tried to move away from that to more flexible capabilities, and Putin has, in 1999, took it one step further. He said, I'll threaten nuclear weapons right up front before conventional conflict to tell you, the United States and your allies, back down, don't come to the defense of your friends. And so, as Sun Tzu says, the acme of national strategy is to win without war. So you just walk in and take over. That's the issue that we're facing in Ukraine, is how reckless was Mr. Putin going to be if he loses or wants to win quickly? Does he use nuclear weapons against Ukraine or against a NATO ally or a military base in the region?
Peter, let's talk a little bit about the doctrine that more recently he's enunciated, and I think it's now agreed that it's part of his canon, namely the escalate to de-escalate strategy. What does that mean in practice, and how might it apply in a place like Ukraine?
Well, what it means is that I threaten to escalate upwards with nuclear weapons in order to get you, Ukraine, and your allies to stand down and de-escalate so I win, you lose. That's essentially what General Hyten talked about, the former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs, when he announced this, six, 7 years ago, when he said Putin is going in that direction. And what's interesting is the spokespeople and officials in the Obama, Bush, and Trump, and now Biden administration have acknowledged in congressional testimony that's, in fact, where Putin's going or has gone.
And he has engaged in a very extensive modernization program, not only of his strategic forces, but also of these tactical weapon systems that might well be applicable in the event he decides to do something in Ukraine. Talk a little bit about the fact that we have seen him not simply introducing new delivery systems of various kinds and new front ends, new nuclear weapons that go on them, but some exotic capabilities that might lend themselves to tactical battlefield use.
Right. In 1999, when he was Secretary of the National Security Council in Russia, he had put out a plan, which when he became president, he implemented. He announced that he would. In 2004, he said, we're going to be going forward with this. We have 20, and Mark Schneider says, you have 25 nuclear systems that are strategic, I mean, long range. And then he said, I'll be done by the year 2020. Well, he's 89 point something percent done. And in the theater area, he's done all things that he's done of dozens of systems. But what's interesting, he has all different kinds of warheads and warhead effects where they kill people rather than buildings, or they go after certain types of targets. And it's 55% of everything he's building is not under arms control, as opposed to the United States, a couple percent. Okay.
And that's a question that we're going to come back to in just a moment, Peter. But before we do, just another facet of this, which I think is hard to, well, overstate its importance. And that is, to the extent that he's got a doctrine to use nuclear weapons, he's been putting into place a variety of systems that he thinks he might be able to use, perhaps without fear of retaliation because of their unique and limited effects on, say, the battlefield in a place like Ukraine, a non-NATO member. But Peter, talk a little bit about the kinds of exercises that Putin has personally presided over for most of his time as the top dog in the Kremlin, and what that suggests again about the degree to which there may be an actual readiness to, well, engage in what we long called the unthinkable.
Well, part of it is this coercion and this blackmail, this threat. And what he does is, instead of just talking about it and putting it down on paper, he says, oh, by the way, this is what I'm going to do. And he does these exercises with the Navy, with the Russian Air Force, and both all three land-based, sea-based, and air-based systems. And he's done it in conjunction with, guess whom? China. And they've done it in the Black Sea. They've done it in the South China Sea. They've done it in the Baltic. So basically what he's done is said, you may think I'm bluffing, but here's what would happen. And then the question is, we basically have to decide, do you want to get into that fight? And is he bluffing? Because how reckless do you think he's going to be? That's part of his strategy, which is to get us to stand down in a crisis, not just Ukraine, but any subsequent crisis, is to basically get us out of the game before the game even begins.
Talk a little bit about that China piece, if you would, Peter, because China has been engaging in its own nuclear weapons buildup, as you know. There's a lot of uncertainty, I guess, as to how far China is prepared to go in supporting Putin. But what do we take away from these exercises in terms of a willingness to collaborate, even in, well, simulated, fortunately, to this point, nuclear attacks against the United States itself?
Well, as Admiral Richard, who is head of our strategic command in Omaha, who's the number one military expert on this business, has said, China is engaging in what's called a breathtaking modernization of its systems, land, air, and sea, and they're under no arms control limits whatsoever. And what's interesting is China has built a 350 new silos out in western China, all of which can take the DF-41, which is a 10 warhead missile. You can do the math. That comes to 3,500 warheads, and building silos is a pretty easy thing to do. Phil Carber told me the other day that China called up Ukraine in 1999 and said, how do you build a mobile launcher for ICBMs, which the Ukrainians did during the Cold War and during the Soviet Union? That's what they specialized in. And so China was planning this in 1999.
Peter, I have to ask you to hold this thought. We're going to come right back with more with Peter Husey of the Hudson Institute, talking about nuclear war fighting and the extent to which we may be looking at that prospect, perhaps from Russia, perhaps with some help from its Chinese friends. Much more to say about all of this, and we'll do so in particular about what we need to do in response right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. There's something surreal about the unfolding nightmare along America's southwestern border. As a direct result of Biden administration policies, roughly 3 million people from all over the world entered the United States illegally over the past 12 months. 200,000 of them entered in March alone, and that number will soon swell dramatically, thanks to President Biden's recent elimination of pandemic-related restrictions. Then there are the roughly 125,000 mostly unvetted Afghans brought here by the U.S. government. What is surreal is not just that the ominous social, economic, demographic, and electoral impacts of this influx are being minimized. The fact that unaccompanied military-age men make up large percentages of these migrant populations suggests a literal invasion is underway with potentially dire national security implications. Will it take widespread violence here by such invaders before we awaken to this danger? This is Frank Gaffney.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are talking about the unthinkable for many of us, the possibility that perhaps triggered by a, well, unsatisfactory outcome in prospect for Vladimir Putin, that he may act to use nuclear weapons to try to decide the conflict on his terms and to keep everyone else from interfering with his accomplishment of what seems now to be pretty much the wholesale destruction of Ukraine. Peter Husey is our guest. He's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a specialist on nuclear strategy and policies and arms control and programs. And it's always good to have a chance to visit with him. And Peter, you were talking, I'm sorry we had to break there, about China's long-term involvement in a nuclear weapons buildup of its own and how that might tie into, well, Putin's calculations about what he can get away with. Finish that thought, if you would.
It's very important to understand that we often get accused of our modernization is triggering their modernization. Kind of a tit for tat. China started their modernization in 1999, the same year Putin put his plans together. And China called up Ukraine and said, would you teach us how to build a mobile launcher for big ICBMs? And the Ukrainians specialized in that during the Cold War because they were part of the Soviet Union and deployed the SS-18s and SS-24s. So they helped China, and it was a money thing, I think, by and large for Ukraine. But China now is in the business of building to a minimum of 1,000 warheads. My view is others, analysts are right about this, that they're going to multiple thousands. And they've adopted the same policy as Putin with respect to not Ukraine, but Taiwan, which is if you, America, come to the defense of Taiwan, we're going to nuke you. Now, what did they say with respect to that? Well, Japan said that Japan would come to the defense of Taiwan if attacked. And China said, oh, really? If you do, we will nuclear attack you over and over again until, quote, you surrender for the second time as you did in World War II. So that's a very explicit threat to use nuclear weapons against an ally of the United States, Japan, that is not nuclear armed, but that China would have no compulsion about using nuclear weapons against. That tells you the seriousness with which China is basically joining Russia in the same kind of strategy.
Yeah, and Peter, this brings us to, unfortunately, deep, well, concern that I have about the adequacy of our deterrent and whether it may be causing both the Russians and the Chinese to believe that they can not only make such threats, but perhaps act upon them with impunity. You've studied closely the condition of our nuclear forces over the years. You've, as I said, convened many, many conversations with senior officials talking about both where we are now and where we better get to. Give us a snapshot at the moment as to the condition of the U.S. nuclear forces, tactical theater, as well as strategic, if you would.
Well, they're old. Our ICBMs are going to be 55 years before they are replaced. Our submarines are going to be 40, and our bombers are going to be around 60. And we went on a holiday for close to four decades without modernizing. We basically ended everything in the 1990s. Stopped the submarines, stopped the ICBMs, and stopped the bombers. We're now basically since 2010 on a path to modernize, starting in 2029, ending in 2042. The question is, we have a window of vulnerability, as Reagan would say, between now and then, where we are basically modernizing $40-some billion dollars a year, which is good. The problem is the administration has, we never thought we had to build theater, regional, tactical nuclear weapons. We kind of almost got out of that business. And we killed the B-2083, which is the only bomb that we have that can go deeply underground and get bunkers where leaders are. And we killed that in the nuclear posture review coming out. The administration said they're not going to fund it. They also said we're not going to fund the Navy cruise missile, which is, would be nuclear armed, again, a theater system. They did say we're not going to adopt a no first use, but we're going to say something, well, nuclear weapons fundamentally are only responding to nukes, so we'll leave it open with respect to cyber, chemical, or biological attacks. The problem is we have no room to slow down. We have no room for error. We are basically trying to catch up. And as I said, we won't be done this until 2042.
Yeah. And that's the thing that is so concerning, isn't it? That there is this window of vulnerability, to use my old boss's expression. And Peter, to the extent that we are going to have to, make stopgap efforts while that modernization program hopefully goes forward, I'm very worried about the Biden administration's posture review and so on, possibly jeopardizing that, though it seems less likely in this environment. But the question is, one of the tactical systems that we still have in the inventory, although not deployed, are these nuclear-armed sea-launched cruise missiles, the TLAM-N, as they used to be called, Tomahawk Land Attack Nuclear Missiles. What is their status at the moment, and could they be reintroduced into the naval forces, submarine as well as surface ships, and bring to bear something in this stopgap period that might increase that deterrence to the Chinese as well as, of course, the Russians?
Well, we could build them, and the current budget there was research money and development money, but the Nuclear Posture Review has proposed to delete that funding for fiscal year 23, which is the year coming up October 1st.
But let me ask you, my impression was that we still had them in the inventory. They're old, yes, but not as old as some of the other stuff, as you just mentioned, Peter. But are they all now gone?
The Obama administration got rid of them. The Trump administration said, no, we need to do some R&D to bring them back. The question is, you probably would have to redo the warheads and redo some of the missiles, because you can't just get them out of the inventory and put them on board a ship. You're going to have to do some work. That is going to be both Republicans and Democrats on the House and Senate Armed Services Committee have said in so many words, reading between the lines, we need to keep that as a possibility. Jack Reed, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, a Democrat from Rhode Island, has said, I'm in favor of full-up nuclear modernization. As Mr. Cooper, who is the subcommittee chairman in the House, he wrote a piece with the ranking Republican recently saying we need to modernize fully. And he was pushing back on arms control groups saying, oh, we've got more than enough. We've got this new fuse weapon that has doubled the number of hard target kills we can take care of. When he said, no, it isn't done that. So I think in Congress, they don't share the Biden administration's view that we need to cut. I think almost 80 some odd percent of them say, no, we need to modernize fully, particularly given what Russia and China are doing.
From your lips to God's ears, this is very good news if it's true. I'm a little dubious about it, frankly, given some of the characters, including in the leadership. But Peter, let me just ask you this, because it's a piece of this story that I think you have become deeply knowledgeable about over the years, but most of the rest of us know nothing of, and that is the condition of our industrial capacity to maintain these nuclear forces, to modernize or rebuild old ones, if you will. Just take a minute quickly to talk a little bit about that.
Industrial base is basically, I don't want it to get any smaller, and I wish it was bigger, because they have very little leeway in terms of, if funding goes down, you can't have people sitting around doing nothing. Okay. And if that industrial base goes away, whether subs, bombers, or ICBMs, you don't just call up, you know, the employment agency and get new ones. So you've got to put people to work. Now, that doesn't mean, oh, I'm just putting them to work for employment purposes. But if you don't have an industrial base of modernization, as Admiral Richard said, you have one choice. You get out of the nuclear business.
Right. And I fear that we're very far down that road. And Peter Husey, we have to leave it at that. The main thing is that the industrial infrastructure, the enterprise, if you will, has aged along with all of these weapons. Much of it is obsolete as well. We not only need to upgrade those facilities, but also to make sure we've got qualified people manning them. Peter Husey, we have to thank you for your time today. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon with updates on this hugely important topic. Next up, we're going to speak to a valiant freedom fighter, a whistleblower from Google by the name of Zach Voorhees, with a plan for what to do to protect free speech, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest. He's a man I've come to admire greatly for his courage and his, well, tenacity in fighting for freedom. He was a Google expert and practitioner at both Google and YouTube. As a software engineer, until he realized what that company, the parent company and and YouTube, its subsidiary, were doing to suppress free speech. And Zach Voorhees didn't want any part of that and left the building, as they say, equipped with quite a lot of information and documentation about the censorship that Google and its various enterprises were engaged in. And he has ever since been both warning about what this means for freedom, freedom of speech, obviously, but freedom more generally, and now has embarked upon a new venture to try to help counter those censorship activities. And we're going to talk with him about both his experience and insights into the problem we have and what he is trying to do about it. Zach Voorhees, it's great to have you here at Securing America. Welcome.
Frank, thank you for having me back on the program.
It's a delight. Let me start by just asking you to sort of level set with us on your experiences and insights into this phenomenon of having big tech, IT and software and other techniques used to try to deny Americans their constitutional right to free expression.
Right. So the short version of the story is that Google started off as a libertarian organization. When they went IPO, they had a constitution which included don't be evil and also organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. I agreed with that. And I felt that the company embraced my personal values as well as many of the values around the corporation with the employees. And but in 2016, when the wrong presidential candidate won the election, Google decided that they were going to put a lid on populism.
Wrong from the point of view of Google, right. Let the record show.
And so they decided they were going to reverse that and that they were going to turn their entire corporation from something that helped people express freedom to something that stamped it out. And that's where we are today, where you say the wrong thing and your entire YouTube channel could be completely eliminated. Your website can be pulled from all ad funding. And we're in a state of extreme censorship by a corporation that promised that they wouldn't do such things.
Zach, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence of this phenomenon of censorship, but one of the most consequential instances was how Google and YouTube and other big tech operations suppressed information about the laptop that Hunter Biden had turned over to a technician that had all kinds of information deeply suggestive of compromises of not only him but his father by hostile powers, including the Chinese Communist Party. Talk a little bit about that as an example of what was done to keep the American people in the dark about something that the Silicon Valley guys didn't want them to know and that they had a need to know about before that election.
Right. You know, so it was in October of 2020, and Hunter Biden's laptop was turned in to authorities because it had highly compromised material on it, compromising him, compromising the integrity of the presidency. It revealed that there was collusion between him and Ukraine with Zelensky and Burisma, and that this was the president's son. It allowed us a little bit of insight into how these elites operate. And unfortunately, the media came out and said that it was Russian disinformation. We know now that it was not, that it was real. And as a result of that proclamation, big tech banned it. They banned it on YouTube. They banned it on Twitter. And millions of Americans were not shown the truth. It was hidden from them from big tech. And
you know, what's really important, Zach, is that there has been polling that indicates that large numbers of people, including Democrats, who voted for Joe Biden said they wouldn't have done so if they actually had that information at hand. Which brings me to what you're trying to do now to ensure that there isn't sort of more of this kind of censorship and actual interference with not just our First Amendment freedoms, but with perhaps, you know, the very future of our country. Talk about what you call blast.video and what you have in mind for it to do in these regards.
Yeah, so blast.video is a solution to censorship. And I realized earlier on in 2021 that aggregation could defeat the censorship. So censorship, the reason why they do it is to...
And when you say aggregation, what do you mean by that?
So aggregation is the bringing together of different items. And so Google search engine is essentially an aggregation of different websites that it reveals to you when you type in a search query. And so blast.video is an aggregator in the fact that it goes out to the internet and uses a spider, a digital spider, to crawl around and get links to videos that exist on, you know, influencers and newsmakers across the country. And it takes all those. There's not that many. There's only like 250. And it brings all those together into one single website where it serves it to you, the audience member. And if you like...
Now, is this something that's currently done by Google or by YouTube or...
In various forms, aggregation is used, absolutely. But this is, you know, I'm not a big corporation. I'm just, you know, trying to launch a service. And so I scaled that down to 250 different people that are scanned. And because of that, we can find and identify trends across the internet. And you can basically get what everyone is talking about every single day, 24 hours in that day. And because of this...
And there are videos in particular.
Yeah, it's videos, presumably. You know, like people like you, people, you know, that like Tim Pool, Joe Rogan, these really, you know, foundational, like viral content creators that a lot of people know that are being suppressed. And the thing is that they're going to be suppressed on YouTube and then, you know, possibly various other video hosts. And the thing is as long as they exist somewhere on the internet, blast.video will be able to scan them and ingest them and bring them in to the website and provide you, the audience member, a link to that content creator.
Wow. Now, is this a subscription service or is this a free platform? How do you see it both serving this need and evolving in the days to come?
Right now, it's completely free. I'm going to keep it free for the foreseeable future. We are monetizing via donations, which is done through a GiveSendGo.
How do people do that?
So if you go to the website, blast.video, you'll get a pop-up eventually that will have you go to the support page, or you can hit the heart icon at the upper right-hand corner. And, you know, we're keeping this project alive based on your donations, and we're going to keep it alive through 2022 and hopefully through 2024. I'd really like to have this up there for, you know, for the next elections. So the next Hunter Biden laptop incident can't happen.
Well, and it's coming for sure. So this takes on, again, a vital, urgent importance. When you talk about aggregation, Zach, to the extent that the average consumer wants access to information and has no idea that Google is limiting their search or providing them what Google wants them to know rather than what they may be actually seeking, your platform is going to get around that by what technique? You know, obviously you're not malignly trying to control, but is there something that blast.video will be predicated upon that ensures that you get what you're looking for and you get it when you are looking for it?
It's able to scan other people's for videos, right? Like, let's say you've got Dan Bongino. You know, he used to exist on YouTube. Now he no longer does. He operates at Rumble now. And if he gets censored at Rumble, he's going to go to BitChute. And, you know, all of those platforms are being scanned by blast.video in order to make sure that his videos get to the front. So in order for him to get banned off of blast.video, he literally has to get banned off of every single platform. And there's just so many platforms. I don't think that we're in a state right now where he can get banned from everything.
So would it, as long as it's on his own website, would that make sure that he's still getting access? Because I'm a big fan of Dan's, and I want to make sure that people have access.
Absolutely.
To his
absolutely.
Right. Zach, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but I'm extremely excited by what you're doing. Thank you for, you know, this freedom fighting that you are valiantly engaged in. And I hope that people will check out blast.video and donate to enable your work to continue, and that you will come back to us with updates in the near future. Thank you for your time today. Cleo Pascal joins us next. We're going to talk about China's island hopping campaign, sort of right out of the pages of World War II, and what it might mean for the Pacific and us right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to a guest that has not been on this program before, but I've talked with elsewhere, Cleo Pascal. She is a non-resident fellow of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. She works with academia, industry, and the defense community on a lot of challenges that don't get the kind of attention that they deserve, including one that we're going to drill down with her on at the moment. And that is what the Chinese Communist Party is doing in the Western Pacific that is, well, reminiscent of an island hopping strategy that we used there in the Second World War, and that if used against us and against the free world more generally, could be exceedingly problematic. Cleo, welcome to Securing America. It's so good to have you with us. Delighted to have a chance to talk with you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
I want to level set first with you a little bit. I think our audience is very conversant about, generally speaking, the problem that we see with the Chinese communists. But give us a sense of how the steps that they are taking in the Western Pacific really fit into a larger strategy of taking down the free world, and most especially removing the United States as its leading impediment to accomplishing sort of global dominion.
So this is the core question, right? What does the CCP want? And of course, the first thing the CCP wants is the perpetuation and growth and strengthening of the CCP. But then from how it affects us is one of the ways that they want to do this is to create a world in which China's number one. And we've heard that term, but they actually have a very specific meaning for that. It wants to be number one in terms of what they call in their think tanks, comprehensive national power. And that comprehensive component of it is very comprehensive. So that means being number one in terms of military strength and economic strength, IP, and it all goes, they don't have to be number one in each of those categories. It goes into an aggregate empirical calculation, which the think tanks do, where they say all of our things combined give us a numerical value of 367. Another country is 489. And they try to jockey. So that means two things. That means one, they try to get better. The other is it helps them to be number one in terms of comprehensive national power to knock other people down. And they can do that through various unrestricted warfare techniques, which we've seen across the board around the world, undermining our economies, our societies, our alliances, anything you can imagine, because that helps them become number one in terms of comprehensive national power, which is their ultimate goal in terms of geostrategy.
You know, that's a very elegant way to describe a long-term systematic bid to achieve a new world order, which they are the dominant force, and everybody else is basically a vassal state. So if that's the plan, and they are systematically pursuing it through what they've called unrestricted warfare, What's going on in the Western Pacific, specifically places like the South China Sea and now the Solomon Islands, that fit into that plan to both sort of evict the United States and exercise increasing control over those who actually live there?
So we've often heard this term winning without fighting, right? Where this is the old Sun Tzu term, and you hear that that's one of the main goals of the way that they're engaging in the world is to win without fighting. But actually, if you look at the characters that go into that sentence in Chinese, the win actually, it actually means getting the other side to submit. So when we think of winning, you know, for example, the war in the Pacific, and we're coming up to the 80th anniversary of the Battle of Guadalcanal, when we think there's a battle, you beat the other side, and then that's it. Then they know you won, you know you won, and then you go back to building each other up, and now we can trade with Japan, and they're one of our strongest allies. What they want is a perpetual state of submission of the other side. And so they achieve it through, as you said, unrestricted warfare, which I'm sure your viewers know very well, in order to achieve this comprehensive national power. And so the methods that they use depend on what's most effective or appropriate in the location. So in the case of the South China Sea, it was militarization to create the psychological effect of dominance so that they're much less likely to be challenged by the Philippines, for example.
And when you say militarization, you mean the creation of what I call bastions in various places in the South China Sea, these atolls that they've turned now into full-up military forward operating bases, right?
Correct. And they have multiple roles. One is, of course, as Captain James Fennell, who's been on regularly and who's the expert on this, eloquently describes. This is, you know, these are bases. These are a bunch of Pearl Harbors from which they can forward deploy. But it also has a psychological effect, you know, and this is one of the three warfares, right? Media warfare, psychology, and lawfare. You look at those bases and you get scared. And that's part of the winning without fighting. That's part of the attempt to dominate the region.
And that's not just the Philippines, which you've mentioned, that they're trying to influence in this way. It's, I guess, the Vietnamese, it's the Japanese, certainly the Taiwanese, maybe even the Australians. Is that right? And then how does the forward movement into another important set of islands, these natural islands, the Solomons, play into this larger strategy of winning without fighting? Cleo?
So if you think back to your World War II history and all the sites of all of those battles, you know, Tulagi and Guadalcanal is mentioned, but even Tarawa or Macon, Tarawa and Macon are in the country of Kiribati, Guadalcanal is in Solomons. These are countries that flipped to China in 2019 through political warfare.
Flipped meaning that they abandoned their previous recognition of Taiwan in favor of mainland China.
Correct. And it should be specified that we're talking about the leadership. This isn't necessarily what the population wants or the opposition party wants. This is elite capture in order to achieve this political warfare goal. And that's the situation that we saw happen in 2019. So they're island hopping through political warfare to preempt having to do it kinetically.
Which, as we saw in World War II, can be a messy bit of business if it's, an opposition is in place to resist the forcible conquest of these places. But if they can do it through political means, or as you say, elite capture, it's game on. And that can turn into, of course, new forward operating bases, new power projection opportunities. Cleo, we have to take a very short break. We'll be right back with more with Cleo Pascal, specifically about what might happen if we fail to turn this thing around vis-a-vis the Chinese, what it will mean to you right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're talking with Cleo Pascal, a preeminent expert on a subject matter that more and more of us need to be paying close attention to, and that is the progress that the Chinese Communist Party is inexorably making in achieving a dominant position in a very strategic part of the world. It's the area between what has been known as, well, China, of course, but the first island chain and the second island chain. And just say a word about the strategic significance of those chains as the Chinese see them, Cleo, and how this fits into the larger strategy you were just speaking of.
So if you're looking out from the Chinese coast, what you would see if you're looking at a map is a whole chain of islands. This first island chain, it goes from Japan through Taiwan, through the Philippines and on down, and it constrains the PLA Navy's activities. You have to pass and through channels that are held on either side by countries that are inimical to you. So breaking the first island chain is essential for the PLA Navy, which is clearly China's military focus. It launched more surface ships in the last 4 years than the entire Japanese Navy has combined. Like it is, the size of it is indescribable. It's launching 7-1 compared to the U.S. Navy. So it clearly thinks the Navy is important. And in order for the Navy to be effective, it has to get out of that first island chain. That's one of the reasons why capturing Taiwan is such a high priority in order to break the chain. Beyond that, you start to get to some of these other islands, including parts of the United States, like Guam. Guam is U.S. citizens on U.S. territory. And I don't know why there wasn't more outrage when the Chinese released a video about bombing Guam. They're talking about bombing the United States. You also have the Marianas, and you have three freely associated states, Palau, Marshall Islands, Faroe States, and Micronesia, that have deep and close bonds to the U.S. Their citizens serve in the U.S. military at rates higher than most U.S. states. So you have all of these islands that are either part of the United States or deeply connected to the United States that China needs to dominate strategically if it's going to achieve its maritime goals, which, according to what we can see, are the key point of their military strategy for hegemony across the region.
Yeah. And just a further word about this naval buildup that the Chinese have been undertaking. I think it was Stalin who said that quantity has a quality all its own, but how would you characterize the actual capabilities ship for ship of these new warships that the Chinese are introducing into their fleet? Are they of comparable capability, would you say, or perhaps in some cases, perhaps even greater than our own?
Yeah, so there are two elements to that. One is comparable ship to ship. And of course the U.S. still has, you know, technology that is very, very impressive, which China's been trying to steal and develop and develop alternatives. Yeah. And also with Russian, I mean, if the closer Russia and China gets together, the better the Chinese capabilities will be, because they might get a hold of some of that Russian high tech that the Russians are still keeping close to their chest. But there's the official Navy, but then there's also, they use the fishing fleet. Because of their doctrine of civil military fusion, the quantity is very difficult actually to quantify, because a lot of their commercial vessels could be used as roll-on, roll-off vehicles for Taiwan. The fishing fleet can be used to swarm. And then what are you going to do? Shoot civilians? That's a war crime. You know, there's this deliberate of the three warfares, that third warfare, the lawfare, creates this gray zone effect that makes it difficult to know where to push back. But the key element, actually, I would argue, is political will. You know, you can have a much smaller Navy, but if you're willing to use it and the other side isn't, then that's really the only thing that matters.
Right. And use it effectively and arguably, hopefully, decisively in our case. Cleo, let me cut quickly to the chase. You've laid out a theater of operations that I would argue probably most of us have been ignoring, with the possible exception of sporadic interest in Taiwan when it seems as though it might be imminently under attack. But the game that the Chinese have been playing with respect to this island hopping campaign and political warfare and dominance through non-kinetic, unrestricted warfare suggests that all of this is going to become much, much more strategically important to us. What would you recommend the United States be doing right now to try to counter what the Chinese have been up to with this campaign and hopefully thereby stave off some of its ambitions for the region and beyond?
To understand what's at stake, it's useful to go back to what Admiral Keating testified before Senate in 2008 about, which was he said that that a Chinese official had come to him and sort of said, why don't you take Hawaii east and we'll take Hawaii west? And, you know, we'll help you patrol and secure the region. And I think that is actually their goal for the Pacific. And if you can grab these islands, you can make it much more difficult to resupply Australia and New Zealand. You can almost blockade Japan. You can block off access out from Hawaii. This is the front line. Strategically speaking, this, if you look at a map, this is what's between China and the United States. And so how do we make sure that this doesn't fall into a Chinese sphere of influence? You look at what is actually great about America, which is democracy, transparency, accountability, rule of law, and you help the people of the region who don't want to fall under the Chinese Communist Party's sphere of influence to fight it with us. So in the case of the Solomons, for example, there's a lot of drama around the space. The people who want the Chinese to be in the Solomon Islands are very, very small group, maybe a dozen people. And they just happen to be the elite at the moment, but they're not popular with their people. If there's an election, they will go. So instead of over-securitizing, I'd argue over-democratizing would be the way forward, and publish articles about corruption, the leadership, and all that sort of stuff. And at the same time, make sure that our existing relationships with, for example, the freely associated states are given all of the attention that they deserve. Currently, the compacts of free association, which are the agreements, the financial components of the agreement that link them to the United States, are up for negotiation. The administration has appointed a negotiator. If those negotiations go badly, there are elites in each of those countries that are sitting and waiting for the next election to bring them into the Chinese sphere of influence. Right now, China is using democracy to increase its advantage. We need to make sure that the people who care about democracy and freedoms are given all the support they can get in order for it to be addressed.
Vitally important. Recommendation, yes, but also plan for action. And we look forward to working with you to see its realization. Thank you, Clea. Pascal, come back to us again with updates very soon, if you would. Hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Go forth and multiply.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.